Welcome to the Best of the Left podcast with clips today from Mother Jones Radio, Rachel Maddow, Ring of Fire, The Young Turks, and Lionel.
Mother Jones Radio, slicing through spin.
This is Mother Jones Radio. I'm Angie Coiro. Accusations about a liberal elite running American academia are not new. What liberal-turned-conservative activist David Horowitz brings to the table now is, well, a concise list. A who's who of higher learning educators he dubs the 100 most dangerous academics in America. That's the subtitle of his book, The Professors. David Horowitz paints the country's most distinguished campuses as essentially recruiting grounds where, now at this point I'm reading from the cover flap, these radical academics, far from being harmless, spew violent anti-Americanism, preach anti-Semitism, and cheer on the killing of American soldiers and civilians, all the while collecting tax dollars and tuition fees to indoctrinate our children, end quote. We've got David Horowitz, who's also the best-selling author of Unholy Alliance, on the line to talk about his book. David Horowitz, hi.
Hiya.
We didn't have to look too far to find another voice, because some half dozen of the 101 professors profiled in the book have contributed to the magazine in some form or another. They've written for the website, they've written for the magazine, or they've been sources. Joining us, too, is Mark Levine. He's the author of Why They Don't Hate Us. He's written for the website, and he's been a guest here as well in the past. Mark Levine, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start with David Horowitz. With the very title of your book, you said in a National Review interview that the concept of dangerous professors was attached to the project by your publisher after the book was written as something of a marketing strategy. So do you, in fact, find the professors dangerous?
The book is about the intellectual corruption of the universities. The professors in my book are people who are political activists in their professorial roles, in the classroom, in their scholarship, and they're jeopardizing the entire academic enterprise. If you make universities and university classrooms political, then they will be subject to the same political forces as other institutions. And you will have destroyed academic freedom. That's really what my book is about.
Mark, we're going to move into the profile of you from David Horowitz. I'm going to read a very brief paragraph, and I want to hear back from you on that. Beneath his trendy exterior, Levine, who has degrees from Hunter College and New York University, is an utterly unoriginal incarnation of very old and discredited intellectual ideas. His worldview encompasses a quasi-communist utopia, a classless future where all racial, nationalist, and cultural identities are dissolved. In other words, the discredited vision of Marx that led to the deaths of 100 million people while bankrupting whole continents in the last century. Mark?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't even know where to begin. It's the most ludicrous description I've ever heard. Forget about whether it's unoriginal. That's an aesthetic comment that that everyone has the right to be, but he's accusing me of being responsible for a steady stream of anti-American and anti-Israel diatribes, which is ludicrous if anyone reads the book or any one of my work, where I constantly criticize the Muslim world as much as the U.S. and this idea about being unoriginal or wanting a society where race and class and other issues are dissolved is the exact opposite of the point of the book, as anyone who's read it would know, which is that we need to form new kinds of cultures that, in fact, recognize and respect all cultures and can enrich other cultures, not dissolve them. So the very premise is common. In fact, if you look at the end of that, the end of my profile, it's researched by someone. I don't know who it is, but I fear that a lot of these chapters, the research is done by interns who, you know, probably need to go back to college, because so much of what it said is just factually misrepresenting my views and the views of many of my colleagues who have been doing stories since the publication of the book.
David Horowitz, this research here is accredited to Zvi Kahn, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. How much of your work went into this chapter per se? Did you clear all the facts here?
I'm not clear which what book Professor Levine is referring to. He's written more than one book now.
Well, I'm talking about the person who's taking responsibility for what's in your chapter about Mark Levine.
Well, look, I'm just okay. Actually, we quote him criticizing. I don't I've never met Zvi Khan.
But this is the point.
Mark Levine, I want you to hold that thought, please. Please
okay,
continue,
sure.
David Horowitz.
And but the book actually says that to bring the socialist millennia to fruition, he claims it is necessary to dig beyond the easy symbolism of freedom, democracy, Zionism equals racism, and other mantras and so forth. So I you know, it's not like he's presented as a somebody who doesn't have a critical thought within the left.
But if I may follow up on that, what you say immediately after that is, quote, for someone claiming to be a historian to suggest modernity consists simply of oppositions is as preposterous as lumping together slavery, terrorism, and the IMF. To be fair, I don't think Marx simply reduced it to that. He took together a swell of phenomena of history and says that they all contribute to where we are today.
Not only that, I mean, if I could just interrupt, not only that, the whole point about saying the simple mantras is that I'm saying you have to move beyond these mantras. So to then say I'm operating within these mantras when I'm criticizing, this is the whole point. With all due respect, I don't think Mr. Horowitz, he's reading quotes from my book or the back flap of my book or pieces. He clearly hasn't read the whole book because he's too smart to make the criticisms that are being represented as his own if he actually sat and read all 400 some odd pages of that book, which goes into a very detailed critique of modernity over 500 years based on sources in eight languages. So to say I simply do this, I mean, this is like, why are we wasting our time with this kind of back and forth when there's so many issues we need to be debating? And this is supposed to be a critique of scholars when it's so filled with errors and there's so many problems in the way it's presented that it could never qualify as a piece of scholarship. So, I mean, let's at least get our facts straight. Let's at least have real research done by the person who's the author of the book. And then let's have a real debate.
David Horowitz, I saw the word collusion. I saw words about recruiting and indoctrinating. I did not, and to be fair, I did not read this book cover to cover, but I read it fairly thoroughly. I did not see evidence of that level of conspiracy, where there's an actual unified move to bring in a left-wing perspective only and to boot out any other points of view. Are you alleging that that's there, and if so, what proof do you have?
Yeah, you need to read the introduction to the book, which is...
That part I did read.
Okay, well, the introduction makes very clear what happened. My generation actually did not want to serve in Vietnam, got student deferment, stayed in school, and got PhDs. These people, their mentality was that of political activists, and their spiritual guide was, of course, Antonio Gramsci. And the idea was that the universities are means of cultural production, and they're the path to cultural hegemony and revolution. And so these professors came in with an idea to use the universities for political agendas. Now, political agendas are quite legitimate, but they're not legitimate in a university. That's really what the book is about.
Well, I'm sorry. What I'm asking for specifically is evidence of collusion, evidence of conspiracy.
Right,
where is that?
They said about, you know, of course, you know, they created black studies. The first two black studies programs were Cornell and San Francisco State. These were done by political agitations, actually a strike that shut down San Francisco State, and they take over of an administration building with loaded shotguns, the demand that we're going to create a new field, and that we're going to appoint our own professors. And this is where politics was introduced in a big way into the university. Women's studies followed. Radicals got control of search and hiring committees. They refer to it as Revolution by Search Committee. And they've instituted a 30-year blacklist of conservatives so that conservatives are rapidly diminishing.
Who is that who's established a blacklist, and where's the evidence of it?
The evidence is, for example, that at Berkeley and Stanford, where studies have been done, the ratio of, first of all, conservatives to leftists on college campuses used to be somewhat of a parity with a moderate center, just like it used to really reflect more where the population is. Today, it's somewhere between 7 to 9 or 10 to 1. Among all professors at Berkeley and Stanford, it's 7 to 1 and 9 to 1. Among junior professors, it's 30 to 1. That can only be explained by a political blacklist.
response, Mark?
Look, I've sat in about 15 hirings. I can say, and I will swear on a stack of every religious book in the world, six copies of them if necessary, that never has has anyone's political views in any way begun to creep into any kind of decision about whether or not they were hired or whether they made the first cut or the second cut. It is purely and simply what is the level of their scholarship, how good is their language training, how good is their command of the sources, are they taking the field and opening new sources, how well do they know the country they're working in, these are the how respected are they, how many publications do they have. These are the kind of things that we look for. And to say, and for him to make these claims, it's very easy to make them, but they're utterly unsupportable in almost every case. Does it happen once in a while? I'm sure it does. But you can't generalize to the entire American university system from one or two cases which you can document. That is an unsupportable accusation by any academic standard.
I want to thank you both, gentlemen. You helped to conduct this in a very sane manner. David Horowitz's book is The Professors, the 101 Most Dangerous Academics in America. And you can find Mark Levine's book on the shelves as well, Why They Don't Hate Us. They have both written in the past for Mother Jones and or MotherJones.com.
We know from the experience of what's happened in Iraq so far that we did not learn the lessons from Vietnam about which wars we ought to get involved in and which wars we ought to avoid. The question, though, is are we also ignoring lessons from Vietnam about how to treat our vets when they come home? What's happening to the families of soldiers who return from war? What's happening to the soldiers themselves? It's a story that we really haven't been focusing on that much in American culture and in American politics. As we see Iraq War veterans returning home to their families, I think it's a story that we ought to be talking about more, and I think that we will be able to talk about it more as a country, thanks to the memoir published by our next guest. Her name is Danielle Trussoni. She's the author of Falling Through the Earth. Her story, her memoir just published, provides a glimpse into the turmoil in her family caused by her father's return from the Vietnam War. Danielle Trussoni, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Your father is the subject of the book and your relationship with your father. Give us a sketch of who he was as a man.
My father was born in a small town in the Midwest, mm-hmm. And he was raised in a family of 12 Catholic children, a big, crazy family. He was drafted to go to Vietnam in 1967, and he went in 1968 in the early part, right as the Tet Offensive was sort of erupting. And he volunteered pretty shortly after he arrived to be a tunnel rat. I don't know if you know what tunnel rats did, but they were sent down into the networks and labyrinths of tunnels that the Viet Cong and the Viet Minh actually before them had built to discover documents and Viet Cong and all sorts of elements of the resistance that was happening.
And so as a tunnel rat, he volunteered for this. Why would anybody volunteer for that sort of thing?
That's kind of the central question of my book, I think.
Yeah.
You know, the book attempts to excavate my father's personality, which I never could understand growing up and even as an adult. So sort of one thing that I was interested in is finding why he would volunteer to do such a job. You know, the theories that I came to as I wrote the book were, you know, there are many. One was that he was sort of a daredevil, tough kind of guy.
Yeah.
Another was that I think he was a little bit of a control freak and that he wanted to choose his battle. He wanted, by choosing to go into the tunnels, it was him against whoever was down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he, in that way, the way that I put it in the book, is he could reduce the whole crazy war into this one conflict, this one encounter.
Into this one enclosed physical space.
Exactly.
Literally.
Exactly. And I think that was, just knowing my father, that was preferable, even though it was more dangerous, it was more physically difficult.
The casualty rate for people who did this was incredibly high.
Very, very high.
Yeah.
Very high. And in fact, a good friend of his, the man who had trained him, was killed entering a tunnel right in front of my father. And that, was the point where my father actually stopped going down. I think that was an extremely traumatic moment for him.
How long was he in Vietnam?
A year.
In case you're just joining us, our guest is Danielle Trissoni, who's the author of Falling Through the Earth, which is a memoir about her relationship with her father, who was a combat veteran from Vietnam. Did your dad ever talk about post-traumatic stress disorder or the psychological impact of the war? I mean, I know from reading the book that he wasn't enthusiastic about talking about the war when he was sober, at least, certainly,
yeah, not
at
usually.
All.
Yeah. No. After he was diagnosed, because he was diagnosed as having severe PTSD about 35 years after he came back.
How did that happen?
He started needing medical benefits from the VA. He mm-hmm. wanted to have medical benefits, so he had to go through the, you know, the steps to get that, and one of those steps was a psychological evaluation. I had a copy of the report he gave to me after he had it. He's like, look, I'm nuts. But, you know, and I read through the symptoms, and it was amazing for me because I had dealt with these symptoms my whole life.
What kind of symptoms?
You know, paranoia, feeling like he needed to be in control, being worried about, you know, that someone could walk in the door behind him, like mm-hmm. these sorts of just psychological, protective, you know, he had a protective coating over himself. He was extremely hard, unemotional, affectless. Just, you know, there were a lot of different reactions that he had.
That you thought were just your dad.
I thought they were just, that's dad. And all of it, yeah. You know, my sister and brother, all of us thought that that's just how he was. And we adapted.
And then how old were you when you started, when you realized that your dad's experiences in the war were shaping who he was as your dad, were shaping who he was as a man?
I think it was when I was in college and I started actually looking into the war, started talking and started speaking to professors, started thinking about it in a more political and historical sense, that I really saw my father as someone who had been shaped by that war. And in turn, us, you know, his kids, his, you know, my mother, we all were sort of working around this experience that he had had without any of us really knowing that that's what we were doing.
I don't talk to all that many authors, and I don't talk to that many memoirists, certainly. And one of the reasons that I really wanted to talk to you is we're the same age. I was born in April 73. You were born in November 73. My dad served in the Air Force during Vietnam. He had nothing like your father's experience at all. But I feel like this is our generational story about what veterans brought home from Vietnam. It's not our story of having been in war, but it's our parents. It's our fathers. And I almost now, as a person who covers the Iraq War every day, I feel like I almost can't imagine the generational impact 30 years from now of the kids of all the dads who are in Iraq right now and the kind of warfare they're engaged in, the fact that there's been a million Americans through that theater already, the kinds of conflict they're involved in. And I just feel like as a country, we haven't gotten our heads around this at all.
No, we haven't addressed it. We haven't even begun to address it. I think as a country and, you know, just as people, we think of the violence happening in country. We think of the, you know, the collateral damage that happens or, you know, the number of soldiers killed, when actually those those men and women coming home bring that with them, and it just seeps into the community in a very subtle and sort of nefarious way that, you know, it's so below the radar that we don't talk about it. I think that we are going to have to start talking about this, especially because, as you said, you know, there's so many people coming back.
Sure.
It's just, you know, it's a big issue that we have to discuss right now.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, the people who are talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, about after support for veterans who have seen combat, about mental health issues and mental health support and social support needs for people who've been in combat, the people who are really getting that on the agenda right now are guys who are in the first Gulf War. They've just started to talk about that, and we're only considering it for them. We have not even gotten anywhere near the topic of how it affects the family members. And so, you know, the only person that I know who's ever discussed, for example, the high divorce rate among Iraq vets and Afghanistan vets is Paul Rykoff, who founded the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, the biggest organization for vets of that conflict. But the social service needs that are going to unfold for the folks who we've got abroad and in theater right now, just, I mean, it breaks my heart. I don't imagine that we can become a country who can handle it.
I don't think that we're prepared. Historically, we haven't prepared ourselves, you know, Vietnam vets, even World War II vets. These people didn't come home and it just dissolved because it was a so-called just war.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter if the war is just or unjust or, you know, the reasons for being there, those effects are the same. And they come back and they do the same damage no matter what war we're talking about.
Yeah.
And simultaneously, we seem to be cutting, in our budget, money for, veteran services.
Sure.
So, this is a huge paradox. And I think that it's something that we, as a country and just in our local communities are going to have to start dealing with.
Yeah, and it's stories and being moved by individual people's plight that's going to do it, which is why I think politically that your memoir is really important. I know that your father has very recently passed away within the last month.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
And you've written a book about your dad. It's a memoir. It's your personal story about you and your dad, and you're touring the country having to talk about him, having just lost him.
The hardest thing was the wake and the funeral, because the book came out that weekend. It's clear, I think, in the book how much I loved my father,
mm-hmm.
but it's also a very true, well-rounded depiction of him. He's not always good in that book.
No.
And so I think one reaction that people have when they're mourning and when they lose someone is they want to have the fairy tale picture of that person. Like, I would sit...
My dad, my hero.
Yeah, exactly. And my brothers and sisters, like, suddenly everyone forgot this real person and they started inventing, like, oh, he was such a great... remember how he did this when we went fishing and, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And for me, I had this book sitting right in front of me, so there is no way I could fool myself.
Yeah.
So the sort of dislocation of wanting to create a different story of my dad and having the real one sitting there before me was just really hard. I've kind of learned to talk about it without getting upset. But when I have a free hour or two and I'm sitting around and I glance at my book and there's that picture, I do feel myself kind of...
Well, when this tour is over, it's going to be an unusual grieving process.
I know.
Starts, I'm sure.
I think so.
Well, Danielle, it's a great book as a book. And I think, as I said, I mean, I don't mean to be hard and cold about it, but I think it's really politically important, too, because it's through people being moved by your story about what this meant, what your dad's experience meant for you as a kid and meant for your family as a family, that's going to make people start taking seriously the long view we need to be taking about taking care of vets when they come home after these experiences. And I will say, you don't come off as perfect in the book either. You did feed your brother mud pies, real mud pies. I mean, come on.
Yes, we did.
Danielle Trissoni, thanks again and good luck.
Thank you.
Bobby, we have Jim in Buffalo, New York, listens on WHLD, 1270 AM. Jim, how are you?
I'm great.
Good.
How are you doing?
Good. What do you want to talk about?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was listening to the head of the VA and his wife, and they were talking about having visited hospitals where soldiers had come back from Iraq, and they were saying how these soldiers, every one of them was saying how all they wanted to do was get back to their units.
To go back and fight, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm. That's amazing. That shows you how great our American soldiers are.
Yeah.
What a shame it is that we are not giving them what we ought to be, the respect and attention that we ought to be.
I'm a veteran of Vietnam era, and I volunteer at the Veterans Hospital, too. So I was stationed in a hospital in Seattle, Washington. We were receiving soldiers coming back and then sending them off to rehab and reconstructive surgery. I mean, in many cases, 50 surgeries to repair these terribly, terribly broken bodies. And these guys were saying to me, not, oh, I wish I could go back and fight. They were saying, I wish I was dead.
Yeah.
I wish I was in one of those black plastic bags.
Yeah.
I'm going home to a wife and two small children. I look like a monster.
Yeah. Jim, have you looked at what's when you read the reports about how bad these injuries are, the burns, the amputations, the blind, the paralyzed, they're worse even in this war, if you can imagine, than they were in Vietnam. And the numbers are higher. The numbers of injuries per year, it's somewhere around 7,000. In Vietnam era, it was about 7,000 per year. Here, it's 12 to 13,000 per year.
And that doesn't get talked about enough because, I had 100 guys telling me that they couldn't face going back to their families looking the way that they did, quadriplegics and paraplegics and, faces blown away. And, And it's something that this president and this administration shields from the public.
One thing we're doing is we're outfitting these soldiers with Vietnam-era equipment. I don't know if you followed the story where $9 billion came up missing.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that $9 billion, it was just scammed, just absolutely scammed down in Iraq. It's in somebody's pockets in $100 bills. Can you imagine how much equipment we could have bought to protect our soldiers with that? But right now, they don't even have body armor. They don't even have armor for their Humvees. And the problem is you have 35,000 soldiers wounded so far that we know of, and obviously everybody suspects we don't really even have the numbers. We have better technology today than we've ever had, but the government won't spend money on it. You have Bush closing seven major veterans hospitals. You had a situation where there's almost 250,000 soldiers that have to wait 6 months to be treated in VA facilities. So every time I see Bush against this military backdrop where he's at, where he acts like he really cares, where he acts like he's one of them, he's not one of them. He ran from the war. Jim, I don't know if you know that. Go on the Air America website, you're going to see something called Operation Call Home. It's a program to where we actually get donations to help upgrade soldiers' helmets. In other words, we're having to have the citizenry pay for that because the government is squandering money. It's being given to corporate America so they can make money on the blood of our soldiers. It's being given to the oil industry that has more money than they have. So much money, they're coming out saying they can't spend it all. But George Bush relates to those people much better than he relates to a soldier in the field, because he's never been a damn soldier in the field. He ran away from war.
But, you know, one of the strange things that I find at the veterans' hospitals is that the veterans there are so gung-ho, pro-Bush, pro-administration, and I want to scream when I go in there and say, you know, wake up, wake up.
Jim, they're around it all day. You can't really blame them for it. Don't you?
Well, except there's that poll, Mike. There's a Zogby poll that says that 70% of soldiers in Iraq want to get out of Iraq, want the U.S. out of Iraq within a year, that they do not believe President Bush, that they differ with his policies.
Yeah, and there's so much money. There's so much corporate money tied up in Iraq that, you know, that's not going to be the governing policy.
Yeah, well, it has become a corporate war, hasn't it? I don't know if you followed the story. There was some question with Cheney's Halliburton, because Cheney has about $12 million worth of interest in that company as soon as he hangs up his spurs as vice president. And now the Halliburton-Cheney group has been given $250 million on a contract that the Pentagon itself was questioning. They said, here's a contract that there's been no trail of documents. We don't have adequate receipts. But what ended up happening was, you know what happened, is a call came from Cheney to some general in the Pentagon saying, make this go through, and it did. And there's another $250 million that could have been spent on taking care of these soldiers once they're injured, and certainly equipping them better to where average American doesn't have to buy helmets for the soldiers.
Somebody somewhere, none of them playing. Man's got a rifle in his hand, rolling in a bag, then wondering how he got this far. He's just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
Do you ever wonder, though, how the United States image abroad has become so tainted? What kind of a time frame did this take place over? And given that the whole world has basically become a very anti-American place, what can we do about changing that? We're joined in studio this morning by Julia Zweig. She's the author of Friendly Fire, Losing Friends and Making Enemies in the Anti-American Century, brand new book just out. She's also the director of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Julia, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Rachel, for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. During my lifetime, during my, I guess, post-adolescence even, I have learned that backpackers, American backpackers, traveling abroad, traveling in Europe, feel safer putting Canadian patches on their backpacks than American patches on their backpacks, even when they're Americans.
Well, you must have been an adolescent not so long ago, because I remember as a post-adolescent that being an American in Europe wasn't quite so hard. We didn't have to lie and say we were Canadian, but that's increasingly the case now.
Well, is this a George W. Bush phenomenon? Is this a war in Iraq phenomenon, or did this start before that?
Well, I think that if we try to ask the question, how could one president and one war so profoundly globalize opinion against the United States?
Yeah.
The answer is, it's the war, it's Bush, but it's also a lot more. During the Cold War, those seeds were planted even among our closest friends, most intimate alliances, for the sort of resentment and backlash we're experiencing today. And it's not just the Cold War, and it's not just Bush in Iraq. It's also some of the very sort of clarion ideas that the United States has represented since the end of the Cold War as the ticket to prosperity for all to the end of history. Globalization, democratization. Globalization and Americanization are now synonymous. After the Cold War, the United States essentially said to the developing world, this is your ticket to the future, to float all boats, open your market, liberalize trade. And many bought that recipe lock, stock, and barrel, and especially in Latin America, the disappointment has been so profound, inequality worse, poverty up, and the United States is associated with those failures.
Well, lock, stock, and barrel, I mean, that has a double meaning, because in some cases, people didn't have a choice about this. You take poor countries who desperately need the kind of economic assistance that they can get only from international financial institutions. The U.S. has incredibly disproportionate power over those institutions. They didn't get a choice about a lot of our globalization ideas and fairy tales. They had to accept them.
No, but let's talk about who the they is,
yeah.
Because one of the key points of this book is when I talk about power and powerlessness, who are America's friends abroad? Our top 20, our elites, our professionals, those in the private sector, in government, in the media, perhaps with Air America being the exception, we get our information from the top 20 elites abroad in other countries. And it's the sort of exchange of information between the 20 at the top, leaving out sort of the rest of the world and the rest
top 20%
of the top 20%
elites within a whole bunch of different countries.
With a whole bunch of different countries.
Okay.
And so who accepted these economic recipes were our peers. Those people who are very, very good at telling our elites what we want to hear and who actually, well-intentioned, let's just assume it's all well-intentioned, believe that opening markets and liberalizing and privatization was the way to go. The problem is that the United States didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the domestic internal politics within X, Y, or Z country.
Mm-hmm.
We were interested in the macroeconomic profile, the friendliness to investment. The notion was with growth, then you get prosperity, but growth, in fact, didn't bring benefits that was expected. So that issue of sort of where is our ear to the ground or not,
mm-hmm.
is, I think, fundamental to how we got ourselves into this mess. You think about Ahmed Chalabi and going back to Iraq.
Sure.
He sort of sang a song that we wanted to hear. We bought it. It connected to WMD. We were going to be greeted by liberators. Lo and behold, not the case. We're getting our information from the wrong people. That's a fundamental piece of this.
The thing that's most interesting to me about your book is that it's rooted in an understanding of Latin American politics, because that's your area of specialty.
Right.
And you make this very convincing case that America and Americanism and globalization are seen as the same thing. And so as globalization has really turned sour for majorities in a lot of Latin American countries, as globalization has turned into a bad thing, that's just made its American mirror, that's made Americanism that goes along with it and is synonymous with it, that's also turned people against American influence. If it's not, you know, the war in Iraq, if it's not the particular type of...
I'm not saying it's not those things.
It's not, but if it's not only the war in Iraq, if it's not the particular modern type of chauvinism as represented by the neocons and the Vulcans in Washington, if it does have these bigger roots and these bigger things mm-hmm. that we've been working on for a generation and more, how do we ever turn it around?
Well, look, I don't think that the goal ought to be to turn it around, because I think it's a fact of who we are and our size and our power. It's always been around. During the Cold War, during the 20th century, the American century, there was always anti-Americanism, sort of marginal, annoying, sometimes
it's
very
been
loud.
Fashionable
but
anti-Americanism, it's,
but yes,
sure.
on the left, mm-hmm. on the right, here and there. So that's not the ism that I'm worried about. And I think that if we got back to that kind of fashionable anti-Americanism, we'd be in good shape.
Yeah.
The issue is now is that it's become sort of a global reflex. We've lost the benefit of the doubt. How do you get that back? And in large measure, there are policy answers, not public diplomacy. Public diplomacy, Karen Hughes's
right. Pay no
job.
Attention to what we do. Just take these pretty coloring books with our president in them.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, the other day, one of her deputies was in London, I guess, advancing Condi's trip, and she said, Guantanamo is not a spa. So, you know, this is grasping at spas, if you will, to the public diplomacy approach.
Wow.
But the issue really is, there are many substantive policy issues on which the United States, even before September 11, even before Iraq, thumbed its nose to the world. Global climate change is a real issue, and
sure.
We said the science just didn't prove it, and that was cynical, but we've got to get back involved on global climate change issues. The ICC, the International Criminal Court, how we deal with genocide. I mean, the United States does have a lot of power, but we're not putting it in the direction that so much of the world could actually benefit from it experiencing. And also, our unilateralism in general, you know, one of the things that drove Latin America absolutely nuts in the last 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. wasn't so much just the bilateral issues, globalization, intervention, drug war. It was actually how we deploy our power globally. That unilateralism, dismissing institutions that are multilateral, that littler countries need to protect themselves yeah. from the big giant Goliath, that stuff is serious. And there's a somewhat sort of surprising end in the book, maybe, but I think actually manners and empathy and respect, sort of basic common sense ways of being in the world that we have lost, could easily come back in. The Democrats, however, and I do want to say this,
sure.
would be deluding themselves to think that by taking the White House, they're going to be able to reverse this necessarily. This is, I think, a long-term
sure,
problem.
Sure, yeah, it's a long-term problem, but you do portray it as a temporally specific problem. It's not something that just is out of our hands, and it's this creeping thing, and they hate us because we're powerful,
no,
which
is
what you
not.
Always hear on the right. I mean, we are the government that most, we are the country that most pushed for those international institutions that were founded in the middle of the last century. We've come a long way from there, but it was us. It was this country. It was this people. We can go back to that and get back to maybe a less nefarious and more fashionable anti-Americanism that our parents understood, I guess. Julia, this is a great book. Thank you for writing it. And
Rachel,
I hope you get booked everywhere and talk it up everywhere, because I think it's important. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Julia Swag is the author. The book is called Friendly Fire, Losing Friends and Making Enemies in the Anti-American Century. It's important. I recommend it. We're going to post a link to it at mattoonline.com.
It says here F in Utah, but I'm guessing it's Jeff in Utah online too. What's up, F?
It's Jeff, J-E-S-S.
What's going on? Oh, Jeff,
hey,
what's going on? Jeff?
I love you guys. My God, what you're doing, I appreciate so much. But
thanks.
I enjoyed the conversation just recently. I have to tell you that if I'd have known where America was going to go, I wouldn't have gone to Vietnam, and I think we'd been better off taking out people here instead of there. Listen, I'm against violence. I'm against war. I'm against killing. But what's the perspective here? You know, like what they did to us and what they had us do for them and what we got out of it and what we're getting. I would not go to war for America again. I wouldn't lay my life on the line.
Well, Jeff, doesn't it depend on the war? I mean,
yes, it does. Yes, it does. But that was a lie. This is another lie. When I look at those kids, and I was a kid, all these kids laying their lives down for this bullshit?
Yeah, first of all, on these two wars that we're talking about, Vietnam and Iraq, you couldn't possibly be more right. I mean, it makes me sick to think of those kids going and dying in this absolutely senseless war. Not only was it based on a lie and all that stuff that we all already know, but what's driving me crazy is that it's counterproductive.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they're all dying to make the situation worse. And, you know, people don't want to say that. Democrats don't want to say that because, oh, that sounds defeatist and that's bad politics. Blah, blah, blah. But we're not politicians here. You know, we can tell you how it actually is. And the fact is, I got a story right in front of me. That's what I was going to go to if we didn't take the calls, about how the Kurds have begun all these processes of splitting up from Iraq. But Muqtada al-Sadr, the crazy cleric there, has sent in 240 units to reinforce his battle position in Kirkuk. There's guaranteed civil war coming
up.
Jeff,
absolutely.
Jeff, before we let you go, how you did what? One tour in Vietnam?
One tour in Vietnam. But you know what? Listen.
What year were you there, buddy?
So I was during the Tet Offensive.
1968.
Yeah, and it's like, you know what it is, man? If you're 18 years old and your flag is the most important thing in your life, and you go there and you put your life on the line, you come back and you see what we're doing now, it's like, what a violation of patriotism that these people have put us through. And now they're doing it to all these boys again.
Jeff, listen, you're entirely right, and it's so easy to stoke the fires of passion in an 18-year-old boy to say, hey, you got to go ahead and wrap yourself in this flag, and the flag means freedom, and the flag means this, and it means that, so go ahead and kill that guy for me for it. And, you know, and it's something that's sacred and that should be done so rarely for the most important of principles.
Absolutely.
And
what
yet,
a violation.
And yet we do it over and over for things that are counterproductive, that violate those principles, and we, you know, we ruin, you know, the honor that we're trying to build in that symbol. And Jeff, when you were there, how long did you stay in Vietnam?
1 year. And you know what? Now that I'm back, I was there for fighting for people like you, not what we've got now. You know, what we have now isn't worth fighting for. This country isn't worth fighting. I'm saying, not in a foreign land, this country is not worth fighting for.
Jeff, you fought there for a year. Did you,
I actually didn't have to kill anybody.
I was going to ask you, you didn't have to kill anybody.
No, right? I flew with the Air Force. We flew airplanes. We landed in Nang once with 36 holes in the airplane. That's kind of strange, but yeah.
You know, I bring this up a lot, but I mean, what Rumsfeld and President Bush have done with this war in Iraq is exploited the devotion and loyalty that these boys, you know,
absolutely
swear into when they join the military.
I wrote a poem called Patriotism Violated. It's 11 pages long, but you know what? When I got done with that, I moved forward.
Well, God bless you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Thanks for your service to the country. Thanks for calling, and you're a real patriot and a great American. Thank you.
Thanks for you guys.
Hey, thank you, Jeff.
You know, Jeff didn't have to kill anybody, but there was a lot of people in Vietnam, certainly a lot of people in Iraq, who go over there and not only risk their lives, but kill other human beings based on these lies. I mean, we talk about it every day, and we still don't get it. I mean, the gravity. Imagine if they sent you there, and you killed people. And as you know, that when we're talking about the peace in the nation, you know, you saw people eye to eye. Sometimes in earlier wars, they wouldn't.
In World War II,
they wouldn't pull the trigger because they were sick about killing other people.
And then the military changed the language, and it became, you know, collateral damage, and it was targets eliminated instead of Germans dead.
Right, and
or Japanese dead.
Neutralized. Now, that you ask people to kill for you and for this idea, and then it turns out it was a lie, and that you've just made the situation worse. How do you live with yourself? And then you say, no, I'm supporting the truth.
Yeah, and so let me tell you something. You're 32% still supporting the president. It's shameful. It's shameful.
Old man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you were. Old man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you were.
What we did was we went in their eyes and attacked a Muslim country. Now, if we turned over weapons of mass destruction and factories that are producing botulinum toxin and VX and this and that, they'd be hard-pressed to say, well, you know, yeah, they did invade a Muslim country, but doggone it if they didn't find exactly what they said they would find. Well, that didn't happen. That didn't happen. So then what are we doing? Well, we're there. And we're killing people. Okay? Killing people. From their point of view. We say, oh, no. Au contraire, mon frère, we're liberating people. Oh, and how many people have we liberated? Well, we really don't know. And I like this one. Well, we've opened schools. You mean you reopened schools? You see, there were schools there under Saddam Hussein. One of the things I love is when people imagine, and no basis of reality, but just imagine what Baghdad was. And I have a friend of mine who was in the oil business and a trader, and he asked me, at T-R-A-D-E-R, and he said, have you ever been to Baghdad? I looked at him, I said, no. He said, well, I have a bunch of times. And he said, did you know there were synagogues in Baghdad? There were, Tariq Aziz was a Catholic. Women went to universities, and there were female doctors. I mean, it wasn't perfect. Of course, there were the rape rooms and the wood chippers and Uday and Kusay. But the idea that Baghdad was some third world hovel is ridiculous. Look at it now. And the thing that nobody talks about, which kills me, because this transcends wars and this will affect us centuries from now. But think of all the antiquities that were looted. They will never see again. This had to do with this had to do with basis of human existence. Think about it. They were just looted, and we were warned. And no matter what happens, a century from now, when we're all dead and gone, that fact, those antiquities, that record of our human existence is forever gone. Forever, because we didn't care. All right? Mission accomplished.
Thanks for listening, everybody. So the short explanation is that the show is going through a bit of growing pains. So last week was a gigantic clusterfuck of software issues and corrupted files and an entire section of my website that has been having trouble. And finally, the cancer was threatening to spread and I had to amputate. So if you're listening in the iTunes feed, right there are no archives in that feed right now. So if you're a new listener or if you just missed some of the old shows for whatever reason, I encourage you to go to the website bestoftheleftpodcast.com and subscribe, if only temporarily, to the MP3 feed. That still has the archives and the archives going back as far as, like, I don't know, 30 episodes, 20 episodes, whatever it is. And then the full archives you can get directly from the website, although it's not in the feed itself. I hope that makes sense, and just that you even care to hear about that. I am totally backed up from last week. Just because I only put out 3 shows last week does not in any way mean that I didn't have 5 shows ready to go. So this week, I shouldn't even say this because there's a decent chance it won't happen, but I'm going to try, possibly to the chagrin of those of you who wish the shows were shorter and easier to fit in. But here's the thing about this show. It has become extremely therapeutic to me to put these shows out during last week when my software was messing up and I couldn't put a show out. I would go and I would be listening to my regular daily shows that I listen to, and I was getting so much more frustrated at the state of the world. And the reason I was frustrated is because I felt like a corked bottle or something. Usually I hear all this stuff and then I think to myself, oh, this will be great. I'll be so happy to get this out in the podcast. I want everybody to hear about this. And then last week I wasn't able to get the shows out. And so I just felt, it was like the psychological version of what I imagine constipation must feel like. I've been lucky enough to not actually experience that firsthand, so I won't go into any more detail. But it was really frustrating last week, and so this week, kind of the whole point is that I want to get caught up. I don't want those shows to just fall through the cracks. So there may be actually 7 shows coming out this week, and not only that, they might be a few minutes longer than usual. I guarantee what I'm doing right now is the most I will speak for the rest of the week, because the shows are going to be long enough already without me talking. I just wanted to get this out, get a little explanation out. I'm going to be transitioning to new servers. It could be a giant mess. So be forewarned and just hang in there with me. If you would like to hear any more of the specifics or the details of what's been going on, you can email me, hippiesympathizer@gmail.com. I feel totally okay about putting out that offer there, because I do not foresee having to write a lot of responses to that, because I can't imagine that anybody really cares that much. Also, if you want to find out how you can help the show, there are several ways that you could help. So email me about that as well. If you've been listening for a very long time, you heard me kind of jokingly say months ago that I was looking for interns to help me work on the show, and then more recently I actually mentioned that I have one, which is great, and I would love to have more. There's lots to do with the show. That I mean, it's easy stuff, but it takes a long time. And if anyone is interested in helping out the show, it would help me enormously and help me take on more of these tasks, as in making sure the show doesn't crash and burn, so to speak. So if you're interested in anything like that, or just want to send me comments about the show in general, do it. That's all I got for you today. Have a good one.